This series, So You Want to Be a Board Member, consists of 8 one-hour sessions designed for those new to nonprofit board service. Even if you are an experienced board member, with the ongoing changes to the sector, you will walk away with valuable information. Here's session 4. Ensure the availability of sufficient resources, part 1. Whether or not you will be personally responsible for fundraising, you will be responsible for ensuring the organization has sufficient funds, not only to maintain its functioning, but to realize its vision. What should you consider when presented with these fundraising opportunities? What are the questions you must ask? Should you expect to give a monetary gift along with your time? This session will answer these questions. Consultants Karen Eber Davis, Laura McCuska, and Kathy Kingston lead the session.
I want to tell a story, as will each one of us, about how funds are raised in nonprofit organizations. This story is a true story from an organization that's in the center of Florida called Bach Powers Gardens. And it has a lovely garden, and a number of years ago they bought an adjoining estate. This is kind of a Great Gatsby estate that was built in 1929, and it's part of a neighborhood of estates. They were using that as a meeting room, and then as an additional part of the tour of the gardens, you could buy an extra $6 ticket when you came into the admission center and find out about that. And at different times during the day, they would offer the docent to bring you on a tour. As you can imagine, a 1929 building that was 12,000 square feet was very, very expensive to maintain, and they were consistently losing money on that. This organization looked at what they were doing and decided found a way to earn more earned admission revenue by doing two very simple things. When you drive into the gardens now, they offer you a combo ticket. Would you like fries with that hamburger? It's the same sort of idea. Would you like to do the garden tour, and would you also like to tour the mansion while you're here? People already had their wallets out. It's the same price, and their income from that went up by 300%. They also, instead of having docents announce tours throughout the day, opened up the house and put the docents in the tours in the house and added signage so that you could self-tour and the docents would help you around. This not only increased their income by 300% for the house, it also increased their attendance, which was their mission. So as a board member, you may be in a situation where you can see that your nonprofit can make money and do mission at the same time. And that's one of the 7 sources of nonprofit income. So that's to be kept in mind. And Laura, I think you're up for the next story.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Karen. There was a seniors organization here where I live in Canada that lost all of their government funding from one day to the next and unfortunately had to lay off some staff. So what the board did is decide to approach the membership and do their first ever annual appeal. And not only did they reach their goal, but the appeal was so successful they exceeded their goal by 20%. Because they decided to shift from reliance on government funds to member donations, they added that individual giving to their income sources, and it was very successful from then on. And so the board ultimately made the right decision there. Kathy, you have a story for us?
I have a really fun story. As you know, I'm a professional benefit auctioneer, so I'll tell a quick story and then weave some other points into my presentation. This is a story about a small animal rescue group in Ridgefield, Connecticut. ROAR, Ridgefield Operation Animal Rescue. And we worked with them for the first time last year and brought consulting services and a professional auctioneer. And this year, they really focused on donor-centered fundraising and use that approach in their auction fundraising. And one of the first things to keep in mind is, what do your guests want for auction items? And so they were very strategic, and they offered a really fun item. It was a wonderful catered barbecue for 40 people, served by the board of directors in aprons that, of course, had their logo on them, peppered with wonderful ice cream. They had a competitive pit master who made all kinds of barbecue, and it was just a fun item. But they did a great job pre-promoting it, and when my auctioneer, June Dallaire, was in the restroom, she overheard two people talking and said, "I am so going to win that barbecue." Well, at the auction, that barbecue brought, are you ready, $22,000, a barbecue for 40 people served by the board of directors. And, of course, our wonderful auctioneer went to the president of the board and said, "Could you find it in your heart to offer two barbecues?" So in the span of 2 minutes, they made $44,000 on a wonderful auction item, which was creative, focused on the crowd, and involved the board of directors. And the best part of it is they had two parties where they had people who had means and influence, and they turned those barbecues into cultivation events where they increased their friendship and a relationship with potential major donors. So a great win-win-win.
Thank you, Kathy and Laura. This is Karen again, and I want to talk a bit about why we're focusing on revenue and income and fundraising for nonprofits. Without any question, you may be getting involved in the nonprofits because you have a passion for the mission. But very soon, as a board member, if you haven't already figured out, the question of how are we going to fund this mission will come up. In fact, it's considered the number one challenge that nonprofit organizations have. So the goal today is to show you that there's not just one solution to the nonprofit income challenge, but a number of them. Today we're going to focus a lot on individual fundraising and individual donations, but next week when we get together, I'm sorry, in 2 weeks, the next session, we'll be talking more in depth about the other opportunities. So let me share with you now quickly an overview, an outline of the seven different sources, so that you have a sense of what the possibilities are. And I sent in the email from Laura two pictures of pie charts of how nonprofit income, as all nonprofits aggregate together, looks like. So what is the pie? Where do nonprofit organizations as a whole get their funding? And you'll see on those that the largest source of funding for nonprofits is mission-earned income. And this is money that nonprofits receive, like I described about Bach Towers, for doing their mission, that they get paid. And many people I talked to, I even worked with a set of CPAs in the last month, and they were surprised by this. They were guessing that government was the largest funding, and other ones guessed that individual donations were. But maybe not so surprising if you think about how nonprofits are structured. Many groups receive significant income. Think about colleges and tuitions. Think about hospitals and hospital payments. Think about people like a nonprofit housing organization that charges rent, or even Habitat for Humanity that sells houses. Theaters charge tickets for patrons to come in and see a show. About half of most theater revenue is earned income, mission-earned income. So it's a very large piece, and sometimes because nonprofits get focused on other areas, they miss the potential of this income source. And as a board member, you can help them to remember that perhaps we can not only make some money, we can also increase our income. That's source number one. The second source of nonprofit income is this individual fundraising that both Laura and Kathy's stories related to. I call this individuals wanted dead and alive, because this source of funding is everything from that dollar that you give to the nice young people outside the grocery store because they want to take a trip somewhere, to someone who leaves in their will a bequest to a nonprofit organization for millions of dollars. It's everything in between, from special events revenue. It's everything from an annual appeal. I'm sure in your mailbox you get a number of letters, especially near the holidays, asking you for money. That's an individual fundraising mechanism. And it's significant. It is the largest way donated money is given to nonprofits. It is certainly through individual donations. Government, we'll talk about in a few minutes, and corporations pale and foundations pale in comparison. Foundations and corporations pale in comparison. This is a very large source of money, but it is the second biggest source of money of nonprofits. So let me give you some examples, and we'll talk more again later on today. The Morrises from Fort Lauderdale give $2 million to the Georgia College of Veterinary Medicine in a bequest. Another example is 8-year-old child who raises $10,000 to help 97 children from around the world who have a cleft lip or cleft palate to receive corrective surgery because her brother was born with such a challenge. And then also another kind of gift, an anonymous donor who gives the food bank a $40,000 check. So this is a second source of nonprofit income. The first one, again, is mission earned income, and this is individual donations. The third source, and why I corrected myself a minute ago, is sometimes this, in different conditions, is considered the second largest source, is government money. But government generally is the third largest source, and given today's climate, that's probably true, and what's coming is probably true that will pale in comparison to individual donations, or relative. Government funding comes from a number of different techniques. Sometimes there's grant programs. More commonly, there are contract programs, so the government says we need this service. We will pay a nonprofit to do them, and they'll pay per service. And then there's government earmarks. Government funding comes from a number of different branches of the government, everything from the federal government to state and provinces, to municipalities, and then certainly in the states, this is kind of a question for Laura, quasi-government agencies like water management districts and arts councils redistribute tax dollars. That's probably happening in Canada, too. I'm not sure about that. But the idea is that if you're looking for government funding, don't just look under one category. Look under a number of places. Again, a significant amount of money and revenue for nonprofits comes through government funding, 21% to 30%. And even if it seems like it's a climate that no government funding is being given, that's not a correct piece of information. For example, many groups are still receiving funds that they received in the past and competitively receive them, although they are shrinking. And one client I work with received $100,000 in new government money in the last year. So that money is still definitely available and still should be considered as a source of nonprofit revenue to create mission in your nonprofit. A couple examples, Alberta Ballet Company received $500,000 from the Canadian Council of Art. In Utah, Judicial Council received $30,000 to support court visitor program. So that's source number three. Source number four is foundations and other organizations. This is a smaller source. You've gotten kind of away from the big guys now. We're into the smaller ones. And foundations are only about 2 to 4% of the funding of nonprofit organizations. But the numbers often for an organization and your organization that you're working with can be much more important than those percents seem to indicate, because foundation funding traditionally funds improvements, step up, and things that really help a nonprofit to go forward. It's usually not operating funds, but it's funds that allow them to do something new and different, perhaps a capital campaign, perhaps an expansion. One example of that is here in Florida, the William G. and Marie Selby Foundation gave a grant to the Family Partnership Center of around $30,000. They used these funds to upgrade their technology. What they were able to do is buy laptops, amongst other things, for their staff. Their staff are master degree level people who work in troubled homes and help parents to become better parents. So it's parent education inside the home is one of their key services. What they were doing before this grant is driving back up to 60 miles to their offices to file their reports every day. With the technology, they were able to get laptops and do those reports and on the road. And the difference for them was equivalent to one staff member being out in the field serving people. So by looking at their needs and finding this source of funding from a foundation, they were able to make a leap ahead in terms of what their mission happened and what was the mission could be created. So this income category goes beyond just foundations. It also includes other organizations, from the United Way to the Junior League to Kiwanis Clubs and the like. Many other groups give relatively small amounts of money, maybe $1,000, $5,000, $10,000, to help nonprofits, and many of those are available year to year. So half of your success, if you choose to go in this direction and get some foundation or other organization funding, is finding the right organizations to seek this funding for. That's the fourth source. Remember, again, we had mission-earned income was the first source, individuals fundraising as the second, government as the third, fourth, foundations and other organizations. The fifth source is business income or corporate funding. And in the big picture, this is very small, again, 1 to 2% of all nonprofit income, but it's part of a $1.5 trillion nonprofit economy. And the other area that's very interesting about this income is it's really a growth area. New ideas are being worked out every day as we speak in the concept of sponsorship. So a corporation or business may give your nonprofit a grant, or perhaps they'll be interested in the sponsorship kind of activity. So there's a number of different ways businesses support nonprofits, but also it's important to remember with this source of funding that businesses have two goals. They're glad to help the nonprofit, but they also are looking at business outcomes. So a couple examples of this, small example, Verizon Foundation funds the Boys and Girls Club of Miami for $10,000 to help their after-school program and buy a lot of software and educational games for the children. In 2009, a larger example, Cisco and the Cisco Foundation created a three-year cash product and service grant of up to $4.5 million to help City Year to build a collaboration and communication platform. So again, a number of different ways businesses might help, and again, a new area that's being really explored as the nonprofits as a whole, as a community, grows and develops. That's source number five. Source number six is kind of a fun source. It's called everything else or other income. And again, you would not think, I think, by just thinking about it before we came to this conference today, that this is very large, but actually it's up to 10 to 16% of all nonprofit income is in this other category. Most nonprofits earn it. They earn it through interest. They earn it occasionally through renting their building. One example of that is a group called Tampa Bay Watch who surprised themselves. They built a new building on a spit of land. The architect did a wonderful job. Windows on both sides and two water views on each side of the building. And in this building, they built a boardroom, very common. But when the building was built, people thought and said, we want to rent this for our community events. And so they didn't have any expectation of raising very much money from having this and were open to rental, but they're raising $200,000 a year in renting this building out. Another example of this other income is a Boys and Girls Club in the state received through a bequest a golf course, and they tried to run this golf course for a number of years before they realized it wasn't the best solution for them, but they were able to translate the golf course into other businesses, financial aid businesses, not related to their mission, but still provides them income. So it's a very interesting source, and it's certainly something that is probably very, very infrequently looked at by boards, but it's worth considering. Is there other, do we have assets that we can use to help our nonprofit raise money, even if it doesn't help mission? A little tricky. There's some tax consequences, but we'll talk about that more next time. And that leads us to our last source of nonprofit income, and this is actually not cash. It's in-kind funding and partnerships, and it's not money, but it works like money for many nonprofit groups. In-kind resources include goods and services that a nonprofit receives at low or no cost that they would be buying otherwise. And we include this because of such strong budget power that this always needs to be looked at. Is there a way we can receive these services through a partnership or in an in-kind basis? Some nonprofits are built on this. Consider the food bank. Most food banks receive funding, cash receipts and cash funding, but they also receive most of the food that they give away from individuals and a large amount of growing resources in kind for food banks is through donations from stores of goods that are no longer or really close to the end of the freshness date. So they pass and provide these back to the food banks who can use them immediately and get them used. So those bananas that got brown get used and put in banana bread by one of the food bank's recipients. So this is a source, again, it's very difficult to measure this. I've never seen any really strong numbers, but I know it's very significant because it also includes volunteer and volunteer help. Your time as a board member could be part and considered part of this resource. Another example is a group in this area called Close to Kids, and what they do is they provide children who are low income school wardrobes. So it's like going into the mall and buying clothes for your child, but everything is free. The clothes are sometimes new and sometimes used in great condition. Parents come in and get 5 outfits for their children twice a year, including belts and shoes and T-shirts and skirts and pants, as well as jackets in cold weather. And the only thing the nonprofit buys of those clothes are socks and underwear. So again, many groups or some groups are really built around this income source. But most groups access in-kind and partnerships, even if it's in terms of is there someone we can refer someone to or people who can refer to us that saves us marketing costs. So those are your 7 sources, and let me quickly go over them again so you have them in your mind. And again, we'll dive into some of these other ones next time we get together. The first source is mission earned income. The second is individuals. The third, government. The fourth, foundations and other organizations. The fifth, businesses. The sixth, other income. And the final, non-cash, but very important, in-kind and partnerships. So now we're going to go back again and take a deeper look at individual giving. And Laura, you're going to start us off.
Yes, thank you, Karen. That was a great overview of the 7 sources. So I'm going to focus on individual giving, and then Kathy will talk more specifically about special events. But as pointed out, individual giving is an important but yet a much overlooked source of income for nonprofits. It makes up 15% of nonprofit income, and in some cases even more, depending on the type of nonprofit. So what are we talking about when we refer to individual giving? Karen touched on it a bit. I'll just elaborate. We mean really any contribution, whether it's eligible for a tax receipt or not, that's given by an individual. So this can mean many things. It can mean going to special events, including galas, golf tournaments, auctions, thons like walkathons or runathons, just about anything designed to raise money and awareness of the organization. Typically, tickets are sold or fees are charged to enter, or participants collect pledges to complete a walk, a run, etc. These can also be third-party events where, for example, proceeds from a golf tournament run by a company will go to a nonprofit. It can also mean direct donations through an organization's annual appeal or monthly giving, major gifts, and also gifts of shares. It can mean membership fees, and it can also mean planned gifts. This means a bequest in your will, where you leave a certain amount of money to an organization after you've passed on. You can also get gifts of life insurance, and there are some other more complicated vehicles in planned giving. Also, as Karen referred to, someone asking you outside the store to throw some change in their jar, or to round up your total at the store, participate in 50-50 draw, etc. Those kinds of things where people just want you to open your wallet and give them some money. So those are really the kinds of things that we're talking about when we're talking about individual giving. So how should a nonprofit look at individual giving? Let's start by looking at the donor pyramid and some definitions. These were included in your handouts, but I'll go over what they mean. The donor pyramid is what we use in fundraising to really illustrate how someone who is just entering into your organization, making an ultimate, what we call a legacy gift. So when someone comes to your nonprofit, they may join as a member. For example, if they want to become a member at a children's museum, it may be that you have donation boxes around at different places, so you're raising the awareness of your organization. It might be that they come across you online and give you a gift. They might volunteer and might attend a special event. So those people are just becoming your friends through entry into nonprofit that way. And once you've got them on board, you'd probably like to put them on your list to send them an annual appeal. You'll send them some direct mail. Again, you might invite them to some special events, but they're becoming more involved in your organization as time goes on. Also, as time goes on, you want to bring them to a different level of giving. It could be that they give more frequently, for example, as a monthly donor. They could give more frequently through special gifts if you send them a special appeal, and you might increase the pledge or the amount of money that they give you every year. So they're really becoming much more familiar with your organization. And after that, after them a committed donor, then you want to turn them into a major donor. And that could be through a special appeal for a capital campaign, and we'll talk about that in a minute, or endowment campaigns, or it just they may be looking to support your organization in a greater way. And ultimately, you'd like someone to consider leaving you a bequest or some other type of planned gift as a legacy gift for your organization. Now, in general, people do start at the bottom of the pyramid and move their way up, but there are, I've seen examples where someone, you know, has given $1 million and they were just asked by the right person and they hadn't had anything to do with the organization in the past. So people can jump in at any time. There's also people that will leave a bequest that have never even been in contact with the organization. So the pyramid is an illustration, but it's not a hard and fast rule. So some of the definitions, if you're looking to bring people on board in a meaningful way, we engage in what we call cultivation. So that's what you're doing when you're sending out a newsletter. You want to have people come to your events. You want to get people more involved. Maybe you get them on as a volunteer as well as a donor. But you're cultivating them so that they're becoming more invested in the organization. Once you've gone through some cultivation, you can consider asking them for a gift. And this would be sort of beyond the annual. I mean, the annual appeal is a solicitation, but if you want to do a face-to-face solicitation after you've done some meaningful cultivation, then your chances of becoming more successful in your solicitation are greater once you've done the cultivation. And once you've received the gift, you ask them how they want to be recognized. Is it in your newsletter? Is it a really major gift? Can you do a news release? There are many, many ways that people like to be recognized. And also, some people don't want to be recognized at all, so they want their contribution to be anonymous. The most important thing after you've cultivated them, after you've received the gift and recognized them, is to not stop the relationship. And so we call ongoing relationships stewardship, and that's you should be aware that that's one of the areas that a lot of nonprofits fall down, because they receive the gift, they're happy, and then they forget to have relationship continue, and because it can lead to more gifts and even greater gifts. So stewardship is very, very important. One of the things that nonprofits like to have is an endowment. And what that is a sum of money that where the principal is maintained and the nonprofit will spend the interest. So that's really important for ongoing support to the organization, where it's a sure amount of money every year. And the other thing that people or organizations like to engage in is a capital campaign. And this would be something where if they have a specific financial goal for something major that's out of the ordinary. For example, they need to build a new building, or they would like to acquire some specialized equipment, or they want to build their endowment. So that's when you have big capital campaigns. People are asking for major gifts and raising millions of dollars. So does this all affect me as a board member? Well, there's a saying in the nonprofit world for successful board fundraising, the three G's: give, get, or get off. So we often say this in a humorous vein, but it's a good basis to judge the effectiveness of board giving. What do we mean by give? Well, it's important to have 100% board participation. The amount is not as important as the 100% participation. Each board member should give at a level comfortable to them, and grantors look at and are really finding it more important that 100% board participate before they consider funding your nonprofit. What does get mean? Board members should be willing to use their affluence and influence to help the organization. Everyone has a sphere of influence and can also help identify, cultivate, and elicit donors. It's not as scary as you think. And get off if you see your time on the board as your only contribution and you're not willing to participate financially or help influence some people to give to the organization, then you're really not contributing as you ultimately should and perhaps should consider a different kind of volunteer opportunity with the organization. Board membership really is about leadership. You'll also be expected to attend special events. This shows your public support for the organization, and you might even have some fun. And with that, I'll pass it over to Kathy to talk about her special area of auctioneering. Kathy?
Hey, thanks, Laura and Karen. Great presentations. I'm going to talk today in general about special events, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about auctions. So here's what I'd like to talk about. What are special events? What do you really need to keep in mind? What are the types of special events? And what are the benefits of doing them? There are a lot of work, but there's some significant benefits. How do you make money at special events? What are some of the challenges that you'll face? And as a board member, what's the best way to be involved and to help your nonprofit succeed if they choose to do any kind of special event? And then I want to use the Ridgefield Operation Animal Rescue. I told the story about how they raised so much money at their auction, and use that as a little sample to guide you through some of the top areas that are really important in this new economy, and then ways to learn more. So what are special events? Well, they're a very specific style of fundraising, and sometimes they're called benefits or fundraisers or galas, and they're really social events that are set up to have fundraising as a major component. Now, before we dive into the special event fundraising, there's one thing I think is very important to keep in mind, is that special events are very labor-intensive, volunteer-driven, detail-oriented events of any kind. And so it's always important as a board member to keep in mind, are they worth the effort for the amount of revenue you're going to make? So unfortunately, many nonprofits use events as a fundraising panacea. There's way too many special events, and that equals a lot of burnout. And maybe not as much financial gain as the board would like to see. So I think a very refreshing and positive and important way to view special events is that they make money, but it's also an amazing way to invite new and potential donors and supporters, and of course that very important stewardship, that follow-up that Laura was talking about. Well, what are the kinds of special events? Well, it's really unlimited, but here's some common types. The benefit auctions, the charity auctions, sporting events. Laura mentioned, you know, some of the a-thons. You have the walk-a-thon, the run-a-thon, the swim-a-thon. I even went to an a-thon in Ketchikan, Alaska, where, I'm not kidding, they had a snail-a-thon, where they actually had snail races, and that was an ongoing activity now. And they made money from that for a local charity. It's unlimited. There are sporting events where you go and have a paid ticket where the funds would go to a particular nonprofit. There's the trio of a dinner, a dance, and an awards program where it becomes a fundraiser, and sometimes you have all three entities or maybe just one. Then there's concerts. And just a little note, I used to be a concert promoter. Concerts are a very, very specific style, and it's very easy to lose a lot of money if you choose a concert as a fundraiser. So make sure you have good legal support to read all the riders if you choose a concert as a fundraiser. Another style of special event fundraising are educational events where you have speakers and there's a paid ticket. There's art events. There's the bingos and raffles and casino nights or bake sales and car washes and much, much more. And, of course, something that's really a very hot area for fundraising are wine tasting events. And, of course, the traditional golf tournaments are very popular. They're typically held on a Monday night because that's when the golf courses can participate. It's really unlimited. So what are some of the benefits of doing a special event? I look at it as my Kathy Kingston diamond of benefits. If you envision kind of a four-cornered diamond, one facet is the ability to raise significant funds at the event. Another benefit is to raise awareness about the cause. And then, obviously, because it's a social event, there's the fun and social aspect. And I think what is the most overlooked but most important area of special event fundraising is the ability to engage your guests on a deeper level about your mission and deepen your relationships with people, maybe existing donors that come, or you may have new people. This is a wonderful way to integrate them into the organization. So how do special events raise money? Well, I like to call myself the queen of revenue streams because I love to add as many opportunities for people to give as possible into my auctions and other special events. So let's take a look. First of all, there's ticket revenue. And I just want to make a side note about ticket revenue. When you're designing your special event, it's critical to use the budget assumption that your tickets will pay for all the expenses of your event. A big mistake that many nonprofits make is a rob Peter to pay Paul mentality. So if you look at an event that you may have 100 people coming and your events are X number, divide the number of people coming conservatively into what it will cost you for your expense, and then you'll know what your per person cost is. And then I say your tickets for a special event are a revenue source. So I like to suggest adding a certain percentage for profit and then add another level of VIP ticket or friend of, so that people can self-select if they want to come at the regular price or the VIP price, because many people who love you and support your cause will choose to come at and offer more for their ticket. So that's ticket revenue. And then I like to look at this as building a layer cake of revenue streams that come into your special event. So at the base, you have your tickets, which cover all your costs. And then you know you can sleep at night, because if you charge the right price and have the right number of people in the room, every other revenue source is additional funds. The next source would be the cash. People can't attend, but they would like to offer some money. So make sure that's an option on your response card for your invitation. Another revenue source are sponsorships. Sponsorships from large corporations, small business, and maybe individuals, where they actually would offer cash at different levels with different benefits for the event. That is a wonderful way, before your doors open at the event, to produce significant funds for your organization. Once the doors are open, depending on the type of event, and each of the specific types have many different ways to make money, but, you know, for example, at an auction, you have your silent auction, you have your live auction, you have interactive revenue games that are specific to auctions, like heads and tails or the pot of gold or things like that. And then the most important thing that I've seen across the country at auctions, and it's even being used at events that don't have auctions, is what we call a fund-a-need special appeal. And this is more powerful than any live auction or any kind of fundraising activity at an event. And this is the opportunity for you to really showcase your mission. At an auction, it's a way for participants at the event to raise their hand or their bid number at a level that's meaningful for them and offer straight cash for a specific program or service or facility. And it's typically preceded by a wonderful, short, inspirational first-person testimonial story. There's a very specific method. But the fund-a-need appeal can be used at an auction, or it could be used at a dinner or an awards ceremony when you really want to be able to capture the hearts and giving opportunity of many of the folks at the room. Another way to raise money is kind of some games and raffles. You've seen, you know, all kinds of those. So those are the typical ways that people raise money. But I believe you can raise the most money at a special event after the event, and I want to speak to what Karen and Laura were talking about, is that stewardship, that important follow-up. You know, in my where I operate in the fundraising auction world, I want to help my clients learn how to turn a bidder into a long-term donor, and I think that's where you have huge potential. Some of the challenges that you may face is special events are a lot of work. They're volunteer-driven. There's a lot of details, incredible details, and you're typically dealing with many vendors as far as the caterer, the sound and lights people. You may have an entertainment factor, and they all have to be coordinated professionally, and they take a long time to plan, 6 to 9 months, sometimes even 2 years. So I've offered in my handouts I call it the Kathy Kingston Dazzling Dozen, 12 questions you should ask before you do a special fundraising event. Please use this as an opportunity to bring this as a board member and run through all these questions so you ask, are you going to make enough money to warrant the incredible effort that a special event has? So what's the best way to be involved as a board member? I think, Laura, you mentioned it. Participate. Go to the event, be involved, you know, in whatever way that there is, and work the room. Make sure you introduce yourself to as many people as possible, your board member, ask how they're connected. That is going to help so much in the cultivation efforts. Invite your friends and colleagues with money and influence. Connect them to your organization at the event, and make sure that your organization is organized at the event. They have committees and that it's a positive guest experience. You've got to have enough volunteers, you know, the horses to pull the cart. These are all things that you can check in on as a board member. And the other piece I'd like to leave you with is that in this new economy, nonprofits must change their mindset about how they communicate at special event fundraising and general. Because what we know is that people give because of the transformation or the benefits that they see, how they're connected to the cause, and they'll know exactly how their funds and their contribution are making a difference. So make sure that it's a mission-based approach. A couple quick notes on auctions. I teach a two-day seminar on auctions, so I'm doing this just to encapsulate some key points. Couple things on benefit auctions. Why was Ridgefield Operation Animal Rescue so successful? It's because they did a couple of critical things. First of all, they focused on their mission so that everyone in the room understood exactly that they were, you know, a very progressive animal shelter. They provided great welfare and education and outreach, so everyone is connected to their cause. They retained a professional auctioneer. They hired our company. We helped them plan it. We helped them understand that they had to have a fantastic sound system. They had to get the right people in the room. They added an honoree who was very connected in the community, who brought other guests with money, thus the very spirited, excellent bidding on that great barbecue package. And they focused on the no BS factor at events, and I call that the no boring speeches. Make sure they're incredible, inspirational, first-person testimonials that get people connected. If you'd like to stay in touch and get some more information and free resources, you can go to my website, which is howtoraisemoremoney.com, and I have a free report there that can be helpful for you in future fundraising. So with that, I know we probably have a lot of questions, and I'm going to turn it back to Karen.
Actually, you're going to turn it to Terry Temkin.
Terry,
and,
hi.
Thanks, Kathy. I'm also a member of the SAC Affinity Group and based out of Florida. Wonderful, wonderful presentations. And, Kathy, I'm just so glad that you said that events should include or at least promote promote your mission and that you want to turn the attendees into longtime friends. I think all too often people look strictly at, oh, we have to have this great golf tournament. And if we say anything about our mission, we're going to chase people away. So I think those were really, really key points, along with everything else that all three of you said. If anybody else has questions, we do have quite a number already, but please send them to Karen@kedconsult.com. And meanwhile, we'll kick it off. I'm going to try and pair some of these because some of them are similar and to keep things moving. I think both Karen and Laura mentioned something about board members being expected to give funds, and we had a couple questions on that. I'm going to throw it out to all three of you, actually, and you can kind of jump in. One question was, as a board member, you said I'm expected to give money, but I really am already committing a significant pro bono value. And so I guess the question underlying that is, so why do I have to really give my money as well? And related to that, it sounds daunting that I'm expected to make a financial contribution. Am I expected to make a large gift? I think, Laura, you indicated that funders are more interested in 100% giving than the size of the gift. But maybe, Laura, will you take these two questions?
Sure. Thanks, Terry. People who are doing the funding really do expect to see 100% participation. So if you think that your contribution of time and expertise is your contribution, that won't count in funders' eyes. They want to see you pony up the cash. And really, it doesn't matter how much cash, although everybody has to consider what's comfortable for them. I mean, if you believe in the organization, you want to support them, you have tax advantages when you make a contribution. So, you know, usually board members will come in at a level that meets their needs and the organization's needs. So it doesn't have to be huge, but there really has to be a financial contribution.
Okay, thank you. And I think, too, it's important for people to realize you can't keep the lights on with the fact that you're donating your services, and people tend to forget that. Karen, I'm going to give you a couple questions that came in that are somewhat related. The first one, what about galas and special events, direct mail and the like, where they fit into the seven sources that you talked about? And related to that, what's the most effective form of fundraising? And how do I know which one or which of the seven is the best types?
Great questions, and tough to answer in just a couple of minutes. And the next hour. The first question is about how those individual and special events and all that, those fit under individuals, because the goal of a really good special event is to create donors. And it's about you're engaging individuals to come and be part of your nonprofit. And I love the talking about today that was, I think it was Laura, about getting awareness as part of what you're getting. So it's not just dollars, it's getting that community to be created around your cause. So that's really important. That's what clumps them there, is moving individuals from unknown people to inside your circle, and that includes contribution. What's best is really an analysis question. I can tell you this, the big boys are mission earned income, government funding, individuals, and in-kind, and often for most groups, side dishes are the other income and corporate funding and foundations. But groups have created successful nonprofits, which each of the seven, it has to do with your skills and what you're doing. If you were really stuck, and for a real quick answer, if you don't have any idea, I would look up other like nonprofits in other communities and see how they're making their money. And those records are available through their IRS reports, and probably you can make a phone call and say, how do you make your income? So you begin to have an idea of what's been successful with causes like yours. That's a quick answer.
There was a third question that was somewhat related, and Karen, I'm going to throw that one in your lap as well. How does knowing the different source of nonprofit income help the board to plan and strategize? Isn't money just money?
Money feels like just money, and most money is good in a nonprofit. Most people are just eager to have it. Helping to know why someone is giving it and what benefits they're getting out of that gift is really helpful to help induce more of them. So let me pick on corporations. They're really clearly there for two reasons, their own needs plus the nonprofit. And if you don't understand that as you approach them, you miss what they need out of that relationship.
Great. You really did a good job in 2 seconds. Kathy, there were a couple questions here. One was a very basic one. What's heads or tails and pot of gold?
Those are under the category of interactive revenue activities. You know, people want to have fun at auctions or special events, too, so sometimes you sprinkle in a couple of fun things where people pay to participate. The heads and tails is a really fun coin toss game where you might charge like something easy like $20 and have a grand prize. And at the beginning of the auction, we flip a coin, and people who are playing predict if it's going to be heads by putting their hands on their head or tails by putting their hands on their tails. And you flip, 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 flip. Takes about 5 minutes, and the last person standing wins the grand prize. And I've never seen an event raise more money and get people more excited. Think the math. If you have 200 people at your event, at least 100 people will participate. So that's, you know, $2,000. And you get a donated prize, and for me as an auctioneer, it builds energy and gets everybody looking up front and ready to go. The pot of gold, the pot of gold is brilliant. My friend Jeff Maynard out of Phoenix kind of crafted this. It's a raffle, so make sure you have a raffle license, and you sell 100 tickets at $100, which can produce $10,000. The person who wins the pot of gold, you know, they pull their ticket out of the hat, has in credit, are you ready? $10,000, if that's what you raise with this, in credit to spend at the auction or give at the fund of need. So what it does is it puts a very motivated new person in the room who has to spend that money that night. And so it not only generates, you know, excitement, and, you know, so you produce $10,000 that the organization is going to get. They don't keep, the winner doesn't keep it. They get it in credit. Plus, there's a stimulus activity so that the person, you know, that everybody wants to bid against this person. So, or maybe they're bidding, they're the second bidder or the third bidder that's pushing bids higher on an item they really, you know, they might want, but they might not want. So it's cool. It's really cool. And those are two new exciting auction revenue generators.
Excellent. Another question came in for you, Kathy, and that's, I'm a brand new board member. What can I do to best support my organization at our annual fundraising auction gala? This is going to be my first time attending.
Okay, first of all, come, spend money, and bring people with money. And so, that's the most powerful thing you can do is you know, buy a table. You know, you don't have to buy the table, but you could be a table captain. And, you know, if there's eight people, you know, so that's really only three more phone calls. You know, you might come with your spouse or a friend, and you, you know, have three more. Bring people who you pre-select, who you tell in a gracious way that I would love you to come and to support my organization, and I would like you to bid at the live auction. I'd like you to bid at the silent auction. I'd like you to participate in Fund a Need, play all the games that are there, and be involved with us afterward, because, and then tell your story about why you're so connected to the organization, why it means so much. And then I think the other major thing you can do is to not talk to your friends at the event. You know, when during the cocktail hour, excuse yourself, say, as a board member, I have to, you know, greet our guests. And, you know, go up to 5 or 10 people, shake their hand, and introduce yourself. I think that's powerful.
Excellent. I'm going to give two quick questions. questions. Karen, this next one, and Laura, I'm going to finish up with you. Karen, you talked about businesses wanting something in return for their donations today. It's no longer enough to be a good corporate citizen. Can you just say a couple more words about this?
In terms of business or in terms of all the sources?
Well, specifically corporations, because I'm sure where this person is coming from, we see corporations as having deep pockets. It seems like, well, they should be the logical ones to go to. You did explain that they're further down on the list, but what sort of things do businesses want in return today?
You know, I want to answer it a little bit broadly, even though you just told me not to, because I'm contrary. I've learned that. Is everyone gives something to the nonprofit and wants something back, even if it's just that good feeling. So there's always an exchange of benefits, and it's exchange of value, as we learned through the Allen community. So that's not unique for businesses. I think just businesses are much more overt in what their needs are. They have tight dollars. Many businesses I see giving and becoming a good player and want affirmation and want recognition in their name recognition by giving a small amount to many groups. Other groups choose a few key nonprofits to sponsor, and that's what they do, and they work on that. It's a win-win because you have assets and resources in your nonprofit. You have people who are part of your community who can win by knowing about a good business. And sharing that and making that happen for the business as well as your nonprofit, as well as your customer, creates a lot of opportunities. And so businesses are saying we have to stretch our dollars too. And if you can stretch them in a way that there's lots of win-wins for everyone, that's really helpful for the business. Thinking of an example, Laura and I were talking the other day about Del Monte sponsoring a Canadian children's park program where all the kids got a Del Monte food, and they also sponsored a person coming in who was an athlete, well-known, et cetera, and created a lot of excitement for the camp program as well as for Del Monte, as well as about soccer, which was the program. So a lot of extra wins that can be used that benefit everybody.
Wonderful. And Laura, I'm going to be a little unfair to you. I probably should have put this earlier because I don't know how you're going to answer it. But one of the questions are there any tips for getting those $1 million gifts without working people up the pyramid?
Well, it really comes down to who knows whom, and it's getting the right person to ask at the right time for the right amount. And if you hit all the rights, then your chances of success are a lot better. And there are certain things that you can do to ensure that without moving them up the pyramid, especially during a capital campaign where there's a great focus on this wonderful project. So it can happen. It just has to be done by the right person.
Thank you for joining us for this session. If you would like more information, contact Karen Eber-Davis, Laura McCuska, Linda Popke, or Terry Temkin by typing in their name on Google with the word consultant.